from the heart of the Forest City, this is a Craig Needles podcast brought to you by Lexus of London. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
Craig Needles podcast, and yes, it is the Friday Roundtable. Of course, we are brought to you by our friends over at Lexus of London. You can find us at londonnewstoday.ca and classicrock981.com. I am joined here in studio today for the Roundtable by Blackburn Media News Manager Scott Kitching, Steve Holland, the president of QP Local 101, and political candidate Shauna Lukowitz. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here today.
Hello.
Thanks, Craig, for having us.
It's a pleasure. Yeah, let's... Let's get right into it with election stuff. We are less than 10 days out, and I'm of two minds on this. One, we are less than 10 days from an election, and that is, in my, you know, almost 20 years of doing this, that is usually a very, very exciting time for me because I love covering elections. But I just am not sure exactly how engaged with this particular election the community is right now. And I don't know if that's necessarily a London-specific thing. We can talk about it. What is it that's driving these races, if anything? Shauna, I know you're working with some campaigns. Steve, I know that you're talking to a lot of people who are running and they're wanting to talk to you about what's going on with the city. What's driving the conversation in this campaign right now, do you think? Is anything? I'm worried that we're going to have this ridiculously low voter turnout, and we'll talk about how embarrassing that might be. But is it as simple as, okay, affordability and just like really surface issues like that, would you think? Is there anything else more specific than that I'm talking about?
For me, and I hope it's an issue, but obviously the homelessness and housing, as well as on top of that, you know, the downtown core, you know, because we pride ourselves on our downtown being a vibrant area that brings people in. And, you know, we have all these things that we're trying to develop for our core and make it a destination downtown. I hope that that's a prominent thing that a lot of people step up and actually talk about. And, you know, it does seem that a lot of people in their campaigning, that it does seem to be a significant issue. So I'm hoping people come out a little bit more. I'm hoping that we see higher turnouts, but you never know. Typically we don't, so I can't expect us to get more than 40. That's being optimistic.
Yeah, I don't think we're in the 40 zone. I think we're like, hopefully it starts with a 3 is what I'm thinking for voter turnout. I hope it starts with a 3. Shauna?
Yeah, well, I having been at the doors, I would say that housing, homelessness, and general affordability are the issues that are coming up a lot. You know, Londoners are concerned. They see the issues. Having attended a lot of the all-candidate meetings and having, you know, seen sort of the behind the scenes, it seems to be an issue that gets raised there. And engagement is low, no doubt. You know, having obviously canvassed at the provincial and federal level, going to the door, there's less acknowledgement that there's even an election or what's going on. But at the same time, you know, I think the views on some of the all candidate meetings indicates some engagement. I just had a great class with some King's students talking about local elections, and they were super engaged in terms of knowing the issues. They, you know, the political science department there ran a mayor's debate. King's is partnering with ANOVA and London Abuse Women's Center to do a mayoral debate around gender-based violence issues. So I don't know. I mean, I'm always intrigued and interested in elections. So I'm still excited that we're heading into one in 10 days.
I am too. I just don't know if everyone else is excited. I consider myself a dork, so maybe that's the problem.
It's funny. I think there's a couple of things at play here. And just going back to what you said, Craig, about, you know, in the 20 years you've been doing this, I'm on the same page as you. I mean, it for me, it's been 27 years, 22, I guess, here in London. And I have never experienced an election campaign that seems to have less, excitement's not the right word, but less engagement, I suppose, than this one. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. One, I mean, you know, we did just have the provincial election. Maybe people are electioned out a little bit. But I think also, you know, over the course of the pandemic, you know, and this is our first municipal election since, I think people's priorities about what they're paying attention to have radically changed. And I think, honestly, when we talk about turnout and whether the percentage, whether the figure starts with a 3, I think that's really optimistic. I honestly, I will, like, if we're going to have a pool, I would say we're probably looking at like maybe 25%.
Yeah.
At the top end. Like, honestly, like I just, and you know, Steve and Shauna, maybe you guys are seeing different things being a bit, you know, closer to the behind the scenes stuff. But honestly, like I don't hear anybody talking about this. And I think, you know, when we compare it to provincial and federal elections, I think there's an inherent difference in municipal elections that because you don't have the party affiliation, right? There isn't that kind of, like, I think people get more excited about provincial and federal elections because of the inherent partisanship and tribalism. Mm. You know, it's my team against your team and against the other team. Whereas with municipal elections, it's names, mm-hmm. right? And I just think because there isn't that party aspect of it, people don't get quite as excited. They don't give in to that kind of tribalism that comes with party elections.
I agree with that. I'll also note that I think that the other thing that drives it is, if you look, okay, we're having a provincial election, and in the provincial election, there is a ballot question of, hey, how do you feel about Doug Ford in every single place in this province? Mm-hmm. There is no ballot question that's the same in every single place in the province. Or, you know, how do you feel about Justin Trudeau? It's a federal election, you know, ballot question, essentially. That doesn't exist where, oh, yeah, we're thinking about the same thing in Vancouver that we're thinking about in London. So you don't see the TV commercials the same way. You don't see the coverage the same way on the national networks. I think that's the other thing that kind of makes it so the municipal election is a little bit lesser of a turnout. So if that's the case, if we're in the low 20s somewhere, what do you think makes the difference in some of these races? Or is it just simply going to be a matter of the ones that are close, and there are not that many of them, the ones that are close just like sort of deciding this on a ward-to-ward basis, essentially? Like, I just don't know what if there's an issue that winds up being a winner for somebody, or if it's just a who knocked on the most doors and who had the most efficient to get out the vote, because I think that's what might wind up happening here.
Yeah, I don't think that there's going to be any one thing that you know, is pressing enough that will help people get, you know, elected in. I think that right now you've got a lot of people that are fresh, new faces that aren't really known, and there's nothing really, like, I like it because I love seeing new faces and new people and seeing what they can do. But in general, I don't know if people are, like, they're wanting to see names, like, unfortunately, sorry, did I say that out loud? Khalil Ramil, you know, Orser, you know, names that are known, you know, and creating a little bit of, whether it's adversity or interest for people. But everybody, it's very different. I would love to see some real engagement, but, you know, again, I hear everybody's points, and I hope that we aren't going to see the lowest turnout in ages, but you never know.
You mentioned the Stephen Orser thing.
Yes.
I've taken a couple of drives through Ward 4. I'm not seeing signs. I don't know what that campaign's been about. I kind of thought when he got in the race, like, oh, okay, it's going to be a crowded race and he's going to win because it's a crowded race and people, but just there hasn't been anything there. Sean, I saw you tweeting the other day about, we mentioned the mayor's race and about how there's some disappointment as far as we're looking at some of the platforms here, not seeing a lot of interesting stuff or stuff that's really like, to get excited about. What should be in there, do you think? What do you think people would get excited about or you would get excited about if it was in the platform for a mayoral candidate?
Yeah, just some bold vision around, like, where the city can go, and rather than kind of vague promises, what are the specifics? You know, like, I watch Catherine McKenney in Ottawa and their campaign, and I see so much engagement and excitement about the vision that they're putting forward, which is a really progressive vision of what a city could be and responding to the issues that Ottawa's been facing around the convoy, around COVID and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, our mayoral race is very, like, kind of middle of the road and just saying enough to get by. And, you know, that's kind of emblematic of London. And, I heard more people than I ever have before who just have no idea where to fall. Mm-hmm. In terms of the mayoral race, how to vote on that. Because what's, as you've said about the election for many people, is like, what's the pull? what's the issue, or what am I backing here? What am I getting behind? And I'm no, people just aren't looking for more of the same. And that's what it feels like is, you know, we're going to just be looking at the same kind of London. And that's not been a London that's been great for a lot of people. And it's not been great on a lot of topics. And so it's hard to get excited about that.
I'm glad you mentioned Catherine McKay's campaign, because I think that has been a very well-run and interesting campaign for a lot of reasons. One, they come out and just say, running, like a year and a half before the election. Mm-hmm. Like, all right, I'm going to do this. Let's go. Mm-hmm. Two, there's a lot of stuff in there that people are going to be excited about wanting to vote for, and that's great. And three, I think that they're going to win.
Like, yeah, so, I know. So, I know. It's exciting.
So you look at that campaign and you think, hey, wait a sec. Like, maybe this could be done in other places. Then you look at, like, let's say Toronto as a compare and contrast. Well, it's going to be John Tory again. Like, great. All right. We got a mayor on the Rogers payroll. Super exciting. Everyone's thrilled. Like, I just, this can be done in major cities. It's being done in Ottawa right now. I just don't understand why that blueprint couldn't have been used in other places. But this is the situation we're in. Hey, maybe John Tory still would have won. And hey, maybe no matter what someone else brought to the table in London, maybe Josh Morgan was still going to be mayor. I don't know. But from my perspective, as someone in the media, it would have been real cool if we could have covered two serious mayoral campaigns. And that is not what's happened here.
Well, and if there was ever an election municipally where it was a great time to come out with some grand vision,
something bold, something different.
It.
Yeah.
Like you think about the last municipal election, and so much of our time was spent, and so much of the time of the candidates was spent talking about which side of the issue of BRT they were on, mm-hmm. right? I mean, like, Virginia Ridley lost her seat because of BRT. That was the big issue for so many of these races. We don't really have that this time. I mean, you know, you mentioned homelessness and affordability. Well, there aren't really two sides to that. No one's pro-homelessness. Mm-hmm. Everyone, you know, so there's no divide in that sense between the campaigns. So to me, this is a perfect opportunity, the perfect time for especially a mayoral candidate to come out and say, here's my grand vision for the City of London for the next 10 years and beyond. Mm-hmm. Like, this campaign is crying out for that. And it was a perfect time to do it because we don't have right now that clear-cut issue like bus rapid transit. So, yeah, it's a little bit disappointing that we're not seeing that when this would have been the perfect time to do that. And it's kind of a drag.
Yeah, there's nothing really again, homelessness is important. I'm, you know, I work in Ontario work, so obviously that's a big issue for me. But in general, that's not something that really excites people about politics.
Yeah.
And the other factor is I just don't think that there's exciting races. Like, there are some that are interesting, but where's the excitement? Where, you know, what is pulling people in?
And this is why I think voter turnout, I think it's going to be lower in London than other places. Ward races typically aren't what pull people to the polls, right? Typically, it's the mayor's race. Mm.
Yeah.
And I've used this example in the podcast before. Let's just say you live in Ward 12 and you're looking at the mayor's race. And you're like, oh, this is probably, I probably know how this is going to go. And you're looking at the council race. And you're like, I certainly know how this is going to go. Why are you going to the polls? You know what? I'll just stay home. Forget it. Like, so I think we're going to see some wards where the turnout is real low, because the other thing that drives turnout is having multiple campaigns calling people on election day and reminding them, hey, go to the polls. Mm-hmm. Hey, go to the polls. If there are not multiple campaigns doing the get out the vote thing, if there's only one or maybe in some cases zero campaigns doing that, it's going to be a real low number real fast, right? Like, you know that, Shauna. You know that a lot of election day is calling people that you know are going to vote for you and making sure they've already gone there to vote. If no one's reminding them to go vote, they may not show up.
Well, I mean, really, that, you know, it is a large part of campaigning is identifying your voters to get them to the polls and get them to vote. And you're right. If people aren't doing that, if they're not pulling people out, it becomes really easy to stay home. The weather will obviously have a factor and whatnot. But, you know, I know that I'm a dork too and a little bit, like, you know, on the inside too much to really have a pulse on maybe the larger public's engagement with this. But from an inside perspective, you know, what the things that I've been interested in watching is the level of campaigning that school board trustees have done during this election has been higher than any other election. It's just sort of been like name recognition, you know, incumbency advantage, huge. You just vote for the name that you know. And typically trustees have not put a lot of effort into their campaigning, probably not seeing it as worthwhile or whatnot. And that has shifted greatly during, you know, this campaign, in terms of you see a lot of trustee signs out there, and there's there's a number of candidates and certain wards, and at the all candidates meetings, you know, trustees showing up on a regular basis to the wards that they are would be responsible for, to meet with voters, showing up at, like, you know, the mayor debate and stuff, even when they're not, you know, officially, you know, given a chance to talk or have their say, they're there to meet and greet voters. And I've appreciated that, because, you know, trustees are, it's a really important role, and education is something that, you know, there's a lot on the line in regards to that. So seeing that level of engagement from the trustee side, whether that translates over to voters knowing who to vote for, you know, I don't know that that pulls them out the door on the election day, but hopefully they have a few more names in mind than they may have in previous elections.
I would say the very same thing. We'll wrap up that conversation here, but I do want to remind folks that the Craig Needles podcast is brought to you by Lexus of London. Lifestyle with the drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at Lexus of London. It's the award-winning Lexus of London. You can find them at 1065 Warncliffe Road South and online at lexusoflondon.com. Let's talk about what's going on at Ontario schools. And the news came down today from QP that the union that represents ECE workers, represent secretaries, custodians at schools all over the province, 55,000 of them, in fact, they are asking for some mediation here, some assistance to figure out their deal with the province. I think this is remarkably different than a conversation surrounding a labor dispute with teachers, and the province has to be, the provincial government, the Ford government has to be very, very careful here. Steve, I will ask you first, your thoughts on what we're hearing from QP's side right now, as also a member of QP.
So obviously I support my QP brothers and sisters first and foremost. I think that this is definitely interesting. You know, both sides are coming in where they should be. You know, one side's coming in higher, one side's coming in lower. You know, everybody's trying to, you know, that's the thing about bargaining, is it is a bit of a game. And I hate to say that, because these are people's lives that we're talking about. But bargaining is a bit of a game, and you're back and forth trying to get to a number that's good for both sides. I hope that whoever is going to be stepping in to support this process, it will help, because I think that I don't think Doug Ford has a leg to stand on, and maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but I think that this is, you know, trying to go and divide them and make a two-tiered system in regards to what they're offering is really just disrespectful. Should know better. And again, I know that that's part of the process, but again, also part of the process is coming in a little bit more respectful. So I'm hoping that both sides will be able to hammer out a deal, because at the end of the day, you know, they aren't making a lot of money, and what they're asking for really isn't unreasonable.
I think this is the difference between, and when we see educational labor disputes, when it's teachers, I think there are a lot of people in this province who are prepared to say, oh, those teachers, they make a whole lot of money. I don't really care if school is off because of a teacher's strike or a lockout or whatever it happens to be. I'm going to blame the teachers, because those teachers make a whole lot of money. You may not like what I just said, but I think you have to acknowledge there's some validity to a lot of people in the province feel that way. I don't think that is going to be the case when you're talking about a labor fight with an educational assistant who's making $35,000 a year. Yeah. It's just not going to be the same. And if there's no school, I think a lot of people, especially after the last couple of years we've been to, I think a lot of people are going to be very much ready to blame Doug Ford for that, as opposed to the aforementioned educational assistant making $35,000 a year.
Absolutely. You know, I think so much of, like, union organizing is obviously about solidarity. And one of the ways that you get the public on your side is by having the public see themselves in your struggle.
Right.
And, you know, what you articulated there is that the government does a good job of positioning teachers as the other, as somebody, as a group into its own, yeah, with its own privileges and its own benefits that we all, the rest of us, are not party to. And so, you know, kind of bruise up that, like, resentment, which I don't buy into at all, but
it does work,
somewhat effective.
And it has worked in the past.
Although the last time the teachers went on strike, there was a lot of public support for them. But like you said, that's not going to be successful at this level. You're talking about people who are not making a lot of money, who you know, have jobs where they're cleaning schools, they're, you know, working IT, they're providing support to
helping kids with disabilities in class, whatever it is. Like,
Yeah. And so I think the general public is, you know, feels a part of that struggle with that group of people. And anyone can look at the wages that they're making and say, that's not a living wage. That's not reasonable for the, for anybody, never mind the work that they're doing.
Scott, you have two kids in school. What do you think?
well, I mean, when I think back to the last time there was a labor disruption in schools, the you know, right before COVID, you know, my personally, my situation, it was tough because my older daughter had scored one of the lead parts in her school musical, and then it didn't happen and now here we are on the cusp of a possible situation again. My younger daughter has scored one of the lead roles in her school musical, so we're all kind of hoping that this, you know, works out. But I will say this, you know, we Craig and I often joke in the newsroom and make Simpsons references. And I'm thinking about the one, you know, Dad, that the Chinese have the same word for crisis and opportunity, crisitunity. The Ford government finds itself with a crisitunity right now. You just want a majority. And if you can just maintain labor peace in the public sector for a few years, there's a pretty good chance you're going to win another majority because, let's face it, the NDP and the Liberals are still, you know, in a
Neither of them know who their leader will be the next time we do this.
So it could be smooth sailing for the Ford government going into the next election. That's the opportunity part. The crisis part is if they screw this up. If they bank on what Craig talks about and the public, a certain percentage of the public viewing CUPE members in schools the same way that those particular people view teachers, these rich education
workers,
they make great wages and they get summers off and all that nonsense. If they try that with this particular group of workers, I think everyone here agrees, it ain't going to work. Because you're not going to be successfully painting people who are making 35 grand a year as, you know, well-paid, well-off,
they're out of touch
public servants who get their summers off and all that. It's just not going to work. So the crisis becomes, the government, are beating up on these people, and we, the electorate, really don't like it. So if you do the right thing, pay these people what they're worth, which they are worth more than 35 bloody grand a year. I mean, for God's sakes, these are people who are looking after the most vulnerable of vulnerable children in schools, right? The kids who need the most. That's who these folks are looking after. Like, I'm talking about primarily the EAs. But go into any school and see the receptionist. Who runs the school? Who really runs the school? Yeah. Is it the principal or the receptionist?
The receptionist knows every kid's name, every parent's name, because you know what? If I have to go pick up my daughter from school, she knows who I am and she knows who I'm there to see. I'm like, okay, there you go.
And coming out of a pandemic in which there were a few things in schools when they were open that were more important than hygiene and cleanliness, well, tell me that a janitor in a school isn't worth more than what he or she is currently getting. So, you know, my message to the Ford government, and I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I know, you know, politics better than these people, but I would say just as a voter, don't screw this up. Give these people what they're worth. Make sure that that nothing is lost in the schools, and you come out of it looking good too. Whereas the opposite, if you don't give these people what they deserve, and they end up going on strike, and extracurriculars are canceled, Craig, you know, everybody's right. It's not going to be the union that gets blamed this time.
No.
It's going to be the government. And that easy majority that you were on your way to cruising to, you can probably kiss it goodbye, provided that the other two parties, one of them anyway, gets himself a good leader and runs a good campaign. Like, it's just, it's an easy win, but it's a potential bad loss. Yeah,
this could be an easy. I will say there will be lots of other chances over the next 4 years for them to screw stuff up that I'm thinking they may do. It. But hey, don't screw something up right out of the gate. I think it's pretty good advice. I look at this and I think about my daughter's class, and she's in senior kindergarten, and I know the work that, you know, educational assistants do in there and what it would be like if they weren't around, and it just would be not workable. And the school board has said, hey, don't, we don't think we can do virtual learning without QP members.
Oh my goodness, no. Parents don't want that.
Yeah. Could you imagine if we were doing virtual learning because
Yeah.
Like that's a nightmare.
It is a nightmare. Yeah. Like people definitely don't want to do that. And then I think that, you know, there is this acknowledgement that, you know, we have a worker shortage in many different sectors and areas, and that, you know, there is power in workers right now. And that collective power is something that, you know, we haven't seen for a really long time. And so you want to be treating sectors well. You want to be retaining the employees that you do have. Otherwise, you exacerbate crises that we're seeing in healthcare and education. And so, yeah, it all underscores the point that, you know, I mean, hopefully what it does is it means, you know, going back to where you started, Stephen, it results in a solution and an agreement that is beneficial to everybody in the end. And we get there peacefully. So hopefully.
Let's hope, because it won't bode well for anybody if this happens, you know. And again, you know, kind of like what everyone's alluded to, this is going to really, Doug Ford's going to lose a lot of votes. You know, there's 55,000 members in this. You know, but then it's all the parents and you know, teachers that are affected, et cetera. And how many of them are going to be really angry by this? I would assume a large portion of it, and the blame will definitely not fall.
If virtual learning happens, like that's and the government's smart to know that they have to know that can't happen. And if it happens again, they got to know they're going to be blamed. Let's move on to one last talk before we wrap up. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Hockey Canada, but that leads us into something a little more local. So Hockey Canada, their board is gone. Scott Smith, CEO, gone. That was long overdue. That had to happen in the wake of the 2018 sexual assault incident in London, where a woman was paid, according to Hockey Canada, a relatively significant amount of money after she was assaulted by at least a few members of the 2018 World Junior Team after an event. Now, Hockey Canada needs to change, and that's significant. But I want to talk about something even more broad, and that's London Police, because we found out from TSN's Rick Westhead yesterday, in the wake of that Hockey Canada mess, where London Police had closed the investigation, but now they've opened it again. Now, London Police are in a situation where they are being criticized because a woman said she came to them, said, I was sexually assaulted by two hockey players, including one who plays at Western, and I was essentially told, no, we're going to get a peace bond and fine the guy $500 and you better just move along here. Absolutely horrific. And the fact that London Police continue to make national headlines for kind of shrugging off, for lack of a better term, these sex assault cases, like it's just, it makes the community look bad and it makes the policing service look bad. Shauna, what was your reaction when you sort of saw this story and sort of another London focused sexual assault negative story in the media?
Yeah, I think it speaks to the larger, you know, systemic issues that exist within policing and the justice system when it comes to sexual violence and gender-based violence in general. And, you know, there is a particular like local component to it in terms of, you know, in the article, it speaks to the unfounded cases and the issue that was here in London and how high that number was in terms of the police. But yeah, it's not surprising in some ways. We know that, you know, women don't come forward, or people who are sexually assaulted don't come forward to police for these reasons, because they aren't treated well and they're often discouraged. And the harm and the trauma that ends up happening, as this woman has expressed in this article through the story, is horrific, and it's re-traumatizing. Yeah, what to do about it? That's the question.
I don't know.
Yeah. Definitely, I agree with you. It speaks to the, you know, the bigger picture of why this is happening, because it's not just London. It's, you know, it's all over. Obviously, you know, we care about London, you know, and we want to make sure that London does better. You know, I was on Locke's board, and this is obviously an important matter for me, and I hope that we get to the bottom of this, and then we, you know, ensure that things like this don't happen and that the proper things happen. You know, you always have to worry, will this ever, you know, because we talk about eliminating this stuff, you know, and it bothers me to think that this is something that we still to this day have to talk about, and we can't have other conversations that these are still issues in our world. So, you know, again, maybe that's pie in the sky kind of thinking, but you know, I would love to hear the day that we don't have to talk about these issues.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate situation all around. I mean, I can't even, and you know, Steve and Craig and I, we can't even imagine. Like, it's as foreign as anything to us. What women like this woman went through and what they've endured, and then to have something like that happen to you, and then you go to the police, and the fact that she didn't go to them for over a year. You know, some might say, oh, well, why didn't you go right away? Well, she didn't think she was safe. Like, and that, to me, like, that's one of the more heartbreaking things. I mean, there's many things about this story that are heartbreaking. But the fact that this woman did not feel safe coming forward for over a year after these horrific things had happened to her. That, like, yeah, like we have got to do something about this. Like we have to, I'm not a criminologist or anything like that. I don't know the ins and outs of exactly how these police investigations work. But I would think that the baseline would be if a woman comes to police and says, I've been sexually assaulted, the baseline is, we believe you and we're going to look into this and we're to the best of our ability. No corners getting cut. No special treatment for any potential suspect or anything like that. Any of the things that we've heard about happening, again, not just in London, but everywhere, with police investigations into sexual assault. We have to do better. And I think it starts with, and it's sort of become a cliche, but it's 100% true. Believe the women. Because if this particular woman had to, you know, took over a year to get up the courage to finally come forward, you know, what does that say about our current situation and how things are now? That women either don't come forward at all, or they wait, you know, for X amount of months or whatever because they just don't feel like they will be believed or they'll be taken seriously or they'll get anything even approaching justice. Like the situation or the system has to change in some way. But I suspect maybe a good start is just having, you know, sort of that, okay, we believe you, let's get to work investigating this. And right. And wherever the investigation takes us, then that's where it takes us. But I can totally understand why women don't feel as though they have a legitimate shot at justice when they are sexually victimized.
After Unfounded came out, London police said, hey, we're going to revisit the way we do this and we're going to do things in a different way. We want to do things better. And I had Robin Doolittle on my show that I was doing at the other place at the time. And we had, a half hour long conversation about it. And okay, good. They should do things different. That was in 2017. This case happened in 2018.
Yeah, and you know, there's a reason that women don't go to the police. And, you know, this story is one of many. Many, yep. many, you know, and I think it's, you know, the issue that when we talk about violence in general, that they seem like one-off stories, this one-off story about a woman and a one-off story about some bad guys out there. And it is not. And I can tell you the amount of women that I know who have been sexually assaulted is, I can't even gather that number. It's so high. And the number who have reported, well, like, you know, I can't even think
low
off
percentage.
The
you would
low
think,
percentage, mm-hmm. And having talked to women who have been assaulted and talk through that, you know, they don't feel that they will get justice through the police system. They feel that they will be re-traumatized and re-victimized. And you know, I know the police has been doing some work with ANOVA and other organizations to improve the process and you know to address some of these issues. But it really speaks to you know whether we're talking about Hockey Canada, whether we're talking about the police, that these issues around gender-based violence are so endemic. They're so embedded in these systems that it is difficult to tease out exactly yep. what needs to change. And you know, last time I was on this show, Scott, you and I were talking about Hockey Canada, and it was earlier in this whole story. And you know, you were using examples of just how you know, from you know, young ages and all levels of different attractions that children have, how gender issues show up in terms of, you know, hierarchy and whatnot. And it just keeps going and it keeps going. And so, you know, whether we're talking about Hockey Canada, we're talking about the London police, women are victimized, not believed, treated poorly. And, you know, there needs to be greater accountability. And, you know, it's great when these stories come out. And it's just really important to remind that these are not one-offs. They're horrific stories, but these are the ones that get told. And there's many, many other stories that aren't being told.
I think that's a good spot to leave it, and we're tight for time anyway. So thank you so much to Shauna and to Steve and to Scott for doing the Craig Needles podcast and the Friday Roundtable with us this week. Of course, we are brought to you by Lexus of London. Lifestyle with a drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting. The award-winning Lexus of London. Luxury defined. You can find them at 1065 Warrencliffe Road South and online at lexusoflondon.com. You can find more of this podcast at londonnewstoday.ca and classicrock981.com. Have a fantastic weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.